Since the violent extremist group ISIS began taking control of large parts of Iraq, a media narrative explaining its stunning rise has gathered force. It goes something like this. In the absence of a tyrant or occupying force, sectarian hatred has emerged once again and is tearing the country apart.
The destruction of Iraq has returned it to the ancient rivalries between Shia, Sunni, and Kurd.
They injected once again chaos into this system, and all of the old problems, all of those sectarian tensions rose to the surface.
What we have to do is look at where we are today, and where we are today is based on centuries of a sectarian conflict just coming to roost once again.
But is sectarianism the best prism through which to understand the unfolding disaster in Iraq? In a word, no, says Ibrahim al-Marashi, professor of history at California State San Marcos, who we reached in Istanbul.
These are not kind of your ancient ethnic hatred that was used to explain away the conflict in, let's say, Yugoslavia or Rwanda. Shias and Sunnis have inhabited what is today's Iraq for centuries without the events of communal violence that we see today. So in other words, you can't just look at the last couple of years and say it's always been this way. The word sectarian suggests that sects are cohesive political units. But even among groups like ISIS, they, as a Sunni group, are more than willing to kill other Sunnis who get in their way. It would be misleading to call it sectarian. I would call it simply a power play.
Okay, so let's say it is a power play. Isn't the power play seemingly always between Sunnis and Shia?
No. If you looked at politics from the 40s all the way to the 70s, what drove conflict back then was clash of ideologies. It was communists versus pro-Western Republicans. In Lebanon, for example, if you look at the Lebanese Civil War, you would say that's a classical example of sect, Maronites versus Sunni Muslims. But you had Christians fighting alongside Muslims because those Christians believed in communism, and the government in Beirut was a pro-Western anti-communist government. Look at Iraq in the present. If it was sectarianism then driving the conflict, you would assume all the Shia parties, as well as all the Sunni parties, could unite on a sectarian platform. But that hasn't happened. It invalidates the notion that sectarianism in and of itself is driving the conflict.
So what is, and why so consistently, across the region?
What appears to be a sectarian conflict is the nature of violent political conflict around the world, whether we're talking about Latin America or Africa. It just so happens in the Middle East, the contest to the largest of the state, whether it's oil revenues, whether it's the patronage networks that the state provides, happens to fall along sectarian lines.
Then it seems that one part of the media narrative would also be true, which is that if Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki were able to, or if he had, put in a more power-sharing government, then maybe ISIS couldn't find a safe haven.
But you have to understand it from Maliki's perspective. There was a genuine fear in the Iraqi state that the Ba'athists would come back to power. And the Ba'athists happen to be Arab Sunnis. So what would seem like anti-Sunni muzzling, he's not going to do this without reaping some political awards. And we saw that in the recent elections. He definitely won a huge part of the popular vote, and his party was the largest victor in the last parliamentary election.
Many historians, notably David Fromkin in his 1989 magisterial bestseller, The Peace to End All Peace, said that the groundwork for today was laid in 1916 by France and Britain with Russia's assent in the secret Sykes-Picot Agreement that divided the Middle East in spheres of influence. And then later in 1920, the borders were redrawn. Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, they didn't exist prior to World War I. Many of these states seem to be intended to divide one group from another or impose the rule of minorities over majorities.
Sykes-Picot did create states that served colonial interests rather than reflecting tribal and ethnic realities on the ground. Nevertheless, states like Syria and Iraq do correspond to geographical regions that have been closely integrated over a long historical period of time. So it's not so much about the drawing of the borders, but the colonial practices of governance that set up these states to be inherently unstable, where minorities would perpetuate the rule. Iraq's first king was not from Iraq. He was also an Arab Sunni ruling over a new state that was predominantly Kurdish by ethnicity and Shia by sect. That starts Iraq on a political trajectory that will eventually lead to the rise of Saddam Hussein and the chaos we see now.
What perception propagated in the media that is wrong is likely to lead to wrong policy?
I would say, number one, the media narrative, and I see this reflected in policy circles, that this is a sectarian conflict that has been raging on since time immemorial, and that the conflict is simply a conflict driven by differences in religious practice. That's the first mistake, because you're developing policy treating Iraq as three different ethnic cantons, if you will.
The Sunni, the Shia, and the Kurds.
Which also then leads to kind of renewed calls saying, okay, maybe Iraq should be partitioned along those lines. And again, I would say that's a mistaken policy because Iraq is not neatly divided among those three communities. Such a partition would be an even more bloodier process than we're seeing today. And number two, the second media narrative is if Maliki were to resign, all of Iraq's problems would be solved. Sure, you can call for Maliki to resign, but then again, you have a large segment of Iraq's population that was behind him.
What do you think of David Fromkin's view, then, the author of The Peace to End All Peace? He likened the situation in the Middle East to that of Europe in the 5th century after the collapse of the Roman Empire. He wrote, quote, "It took Europe a millennium and a half to resolve its post-Roman crisis of social and political identity and nearly 1,000 years to settle on the nation-state form of political organization and 500 more years to determine which nations were entitled to be states. The continuing crisis in the Middle East in our time may prove to be nowhere near so long-lasting, but the issue is the same, how diverse peoples are to regroup to create new political identities for themselves after the collapse of an age-old imperial order to which they'd grown accustomed."
Fromkin has a point in that it was a peace that ended all peace in the Middle East, but we have to give agency to various Arab leaders who have also put the Middle East in the situation that it is today. The borders were kind of a recipe for a toxic stew, but the cooks at the end of the day were still Middle Eastern leaders who allowed this to happen.
Ibrahim, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Ibrahim Al-Marashi is a professor of history at California State San Marcos, and we spoke to him from Istanbul.